How's it going so far?
Yeah,
all right. I'm a very nervous presenter. You wouldn't know. So I like those little confidence boosts. Okay. I asked for that. If there are people running around doing nice things for me, I would really appreciate a coffee. Thank you. I'm sorry, I got lots of stuff and little time, but I don't want that to dissuade you from asking questions or making comments, because as we've already seen, a lot of my responses will be in slides to follow. I want to pull this together a bit. I'm talking loosely, very loosely, oh so loosely, about the role of education. But also, I'm pulling things together here too. There are some themes that have underlined. The stuff that I've been talking about, the theme of the network, the theme of the ecosystem, the theme of the innovation happening at the edges or flowing from the bottom. You see, I don't think of it as the bottom, right? It's just the wrong analogy. It's the edges, right, not the bottom. Things like that. I'm going to throw some old slides at you, and I feel a little guilty doing that, so I'm telling you. I probably could have got away with it, but nonetheless, they draw out these themes and really bring them together. So I thought that these slides were very appropriate given the discussion that we've had so far, and you'll see what I mean. But I put some new slides in front of the old slides, so really it's not all old slides. So here's what I had planned to talk about. The role of education, and we've covered this already quite a bit, all right? Building skills, yeah, because people want skills, but more importantly, personal empowerment, personal capacity building, so on and so forth, and we've talked about that. The methodology, again, we've also talked about access, access, access. This is the whole consistency thing, right? To me, the first primary and only goal of an educational system is to provide access to learning. And that's my part three. Building the experience. Education changes when it goes online, and more importantly, education changes when it moves from what may be called a broadcast model to what may be called a network model. And one of the messages that I've stressed quite a bit, and I really stressed it when I was talking in Brisbane at Networking 2001, online learning from virtual to reality, and I played their slogan a bit, but it seems to me then, and it still seems to me now, that the capacity of online learning is not to bring you, is not to bring the world to you, it's to bring you to the world. Online learning, fully realized, will free us from the classroom and allow us to do our learning, and I mean us, I mean everyone, from 5-year-olds to 80-year-olds, to do our learning in the community, in the places where learning is more than simply text, which is abstract, which is structured, but learning which is actually based upon or founded upon experience. And in this way, it ultimately becomes learner-centered learning. I'm a follower of Marshall McLuhan at heart. And I see the internet as being like an extension of capacities. I see the internet as being a way to allow me to see further, to talk further, and so on. The internet, ironically, because we're not there yet, but the internet gives me mobility. It allows me to reach back and to get the knowledge and the information that I need while I am in the process of having an experience, whatever that experience may be. So that's prelude. I'm being very conscious of the time that I have, so I have limited time for preludes. Normally I like to do like a 20-minute prelude and a 5-minute talk, but I can't do that now. So let me throw a little thought experiment out at you. It's just to bother you. What if educational institutions lost their monopoly on certification? What if government funding for educational institutions ceased to exist? And the question that I put to you is, would educational institutions look anything like what they look like now under such a model? I think the answer is no. I think the educational system would look dramatically different. Now, that is, should be a concern, because I really think these two things are going to happen. I think that the monopoly on certification will end. We're already seeing quite a bit of nibbling about the edges. We're seeing, you know, like with the rise of things like McDonald U, which, or Hamburger U, which is, you know, a bit farcical, but with the rise of things like corporate universities, certification like Certified Network Engineer, independent testing, all of that sort of stuff, there's a great deal of nibbling around the edges at credentials. And eventually the bottom's going to fall out of that. Plus, as the number of educational opportunities on the internet increases, governments are going to realize more and more that what they're funding, when they fund the university of this or the university of that, or even the TAFE of this and the TAFE of that, is not education, but a lifestyle. They're funding frats and parties and social interaction and networking. They're going to lose patience with that very quickly. As soon as they realize that, gee, there are alternatives to this structured institutional system. And already we are seeing a significant amount of pressure on educational funding. I think the bottom's going to fall out of that too. And then what? Now for the old slide. It's just funny because they're still applicable. This is what kills me. Education on the internet is still tell and test. It's the old model. You go to WebCT, you go to Blackboard, you go look at whatever, and they're going to present you with a bunch of stuff. They'll give you a pop quiz at the end, right? This is back in 95, when I was working with Assiniboine Community College, this is exactly what we did. And it is still the model used to a large degree today. We took an existing course, we converted it to a distance education package, and then we delivered it. And the online course looked just like the offline course. The online model followed the model of traditional learning. In fact, it was viewed as a form of publishing, mostly static, of course, at a shelf life. And you think about what's happening today, learning objects, repositories, libraries. People are thinking of online learning today as something static and fixed. IMS has their thing, content packages. Well, what is that except a static object kind of model of learning? It's very expensive, right? I mean, you guys know this better than I do. It's incredibly expensive to design and distribute learning in this prepackaged model like this. and it overwhelmingly favors large centralized institutions. That's why it's so hard for things like TAFE, let alone the little community school, to do online learning. Who can afford it? Who can do it? That's why there have been a lot of the development of centralized content services. That's where the Learning Market, the Learning Federation, every once in a while I'll have a brain cloud, gets its market from, is that it's just too expensive for these institutions themselves to create and distribute learning content. Centralized online learning. The slogan, there's only one way to do it. And that's the model that we're following now. That's the model that we see with IMS standards and SCORM and packaging and learning design and so on and so forth. I don't know if these are really what I think they are, but what I think they are lemmings. You may have noticed, I have the world's worst slides. And the reason why I have the world's worst slides is I've never actually sat down and read anything about PowerPoint ever. So, and I haven't really spent much time with PowerPoint. I don't have the patience for it. I'm trying to create stuff in PowerPoint. I'd like to use a nice template and colors, little moving things and so on. Trying to get help in PowerPoint for PowerPoint. How many of you have used Microsoft's help? All of you. How many of you found it useful? Yeah. Oh, a couple. That's better than my experience. See, in Microsoft, the only way to get help in PowerPoint is through Microsoft Help. Now, I've since had people tell me that there are things you can build, but they're expensive, and you plug them in, you have to pay the company big money, and then you get a second source of help, which may or may not be as good as Microsoft Help. Right now, despite the promise, and it's still very much a promise of mass customization, there's still no practical way to do it. When we design learning for students, we're still designing learning for classes of students, entire programs of students. We haven't come up yet with what makes, you know, a unique education for a unique individual. And so what we get still is mass distribution. And tell me if this is not your experience working in online learning still today. Large servers, huge servers, massive servers. It's got lots of hardware in there. Software. I've been on a kick in my Australian tour against enterprise software. And people say, how can you be opposed to enterprise software? I am opposed to enterprise software. I think the concept is fundamentally flawed because there's only one way to do it. Enterprise software doesn't give you options. It directs you into doing things a certain way. It's this large centralized approach is inherently unstable. It's a house of cards. It's a bottleneck. This came up later, but you know, looking at Merlot. Merlot is a content repository. The idea is you have a big content repository based naturally in the United States. And what we will do is we will make sure all of the content that goes into Merlot is quality content with a capital Q. And the way to do that, the Merlot way, is to make sure every bit of educational content that goes into Merlot is peer reviewed. Huge bottleneck. They're up to maybe 1,000 items now that have been peer-reviewed. They open the doors a bit so you can get more items in. But if we're in a world where we need tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of learning objects or learning resources, peer review isn't going to work. Learning must be standardized. How often have we heard that? That's the large, central way of thinking. We've got to make everything standardized. When's the last time something standardized worked for you? It does work from time to time if you understand standardization properly. If you understand standardization is how you design the plug-in end of a light bulb to screw into the socket end of a light bulb socket, that's standardization. But if standardization is saying every light bulb will be the same color and the same design, that's a misappropriation of standardization. That's moving from standardization defined syntactically in how things go together to standardization designed syntactically, what things should say, what they should look like, how they should be designed. And if you approach it this way, you have to have common goals. Everybody has to move in the same way. It's groupthink. And it's exactly the opposite of the distributed model that I've been trying to describe so far today. Imagine if we designed the internet that way. If you think about what you know about learning objects and resources the way it has been set up today, what we would have to do if we were building the internet would be to build a big server. One big server. Maybe, if we were really cooperative, we might build 5 or 6 big servers. That's the Merlot model. That's the federated search model. We'll build 5 or 6 big servers, and then we'll call it federated search because those 5 or 6 big servers are all interlinked. And then all the content of the internet will be placed on these servers. Now, of course, we can't just allow anything to go on there, right? Because, well, we don't have room. What if there was one search engine for this server? One news feed for this server? What would it cost? How would it work? Imagine the internet designed that way. And of course it was designed that way before there was the internet. It was a thing called CompuServe and a competing thing called Prodigy. And as soon as the distributed small technology hit, those services evaporated. Internet culture, and this is an actual real slogan. There's more than one way to do it. It's the slogan in Perl, which is an open source computing language on the internet. The idea here is, if you think about this, suppose I needed to find, well, images for my presentation, what would I do? I could go to a single image library like Corbis. Of course, I'd need to authenticate and report my IP and tell them my mother's maiden name, my dog's blood type. And then I would be given a choice of one image. Or I could do what everyone does, I search on Google. And what happens with Google is I have the capacity to select from millions of separate sources for images so that I do have access to the many sources of information that I'm looking for. So basically, the way I set this thing up is I simply typed the slogan I wanted the image to match, it presented a bunch of things to me, I picked the image that suited me. The lesson is this. The internet is distributed. Millions of servers, millions of authors. And if we're looking at how to structure education, how to structure learning on the internet, instead of trying to rewrite the design, we should be going with that flow, thinking of education as distributed, educational resources as distributed, software as distributed. We talk a lot about, you know, creating content, getting content, content publishers and so on. On the internet, anyone can publish content. That's what makes it great. And when I talk about learning objects and things like that, what I talk about is not publisher content or stuff put together by the Learning Federation or so on and so forth. What I talk about is content generated by students and by people who use the educational system. There's no central authority on the internet. Nobody runs the system. And I advocate a similar model for education where, oh, she's telling me the time. It's 2-something, 2:30. Just shout it out. It's fine. It's a very different approach to learning than the approach that we've taken so far, right? It's a distributed, autonomous, independently based, learner-focused approach to learning. So, what's the role of education? To move from the large centralized system that we've adapted and push it down, push it out, push it to the edges. Not just the decision-making, not just the power, but the actual conduct of instruction and the actual authoring of learning resources. You hear a lot of the time, instructors go online for the first time. You see this all the time. It's come up in various papers and so on. And they say, well, I've gone online with my class, and all I'm finding is taking me 3, 4, 5 times as long to do my communication with students and all of that than it did in the class. And I always want to say, well, that's because you didn't talk to anyone in the class. Now you have to talk to everyone. I've been in those classes, you know, it was seat number 430. I did interact with the instructor once because I bumped into him and said, excuse me. And the response that comes when instructors make this point is that you have to distribute the task. Instead of answering all the individual students' emails individually, you put them on our discussion board and have the students answer each other's questions. You have the students collaborating online, building their own learning, rather than you trying to do it all for them. The only way to survive in online learning, if you're an instructor, is to move out of that teaching mode. Have the students do it themselves, because you simply do not have time to do the communication that's required in online learning. Even in the classroom, it becomes more distributed, less centralized. I don't know what that is, but I originally wrote this slide for New Brunswick, but it really works for Tasmania too, and I think the image might actually be more appropriate. There's certainly none of those in New Brunswick. I haven't seen any of those in Tasmania either, but it doesn't mean they're not out there. Small, close to the ground, first to the banana. That's the old story, right? How many of you have used Google? I'm not even going to ask you to raise your hands because you all have used Google. Anyone who says they haven't used Google is, well, either not online or lying. But think about it. When's the last time you saw it advertised? Ever? How did you hear about Google in the first place? Right? Google didn't come from the top down. Astonishingly, because they practically run the internet now. Google exists only because of individual people making for themselves the decision to use it. That's the model of new products and new services on the internet. That's the model of learning on the internet. Again, this slide was for New Brunswick, but it applies equally well for Tasmania. I think, based on what I've seen, that Tasmania is well positioned to offer an alternative to monolithic e-learning. And quite frankly, I think it's the only alternative. Because if you go the monolithic way, you're looking at building large enterprise servers here, having large content houses here, and all of that. Who can afford that? Right? And really, if you adopt the approach of large e-learning, in all frankness, what's going to happen is your servers and your learning content and your instructors and all of that will all be based in Sydney, or worse, New York. But you have existing expertise. You have knowledge and background in network technologies. You have an understanding of things like peer-to-peer infrastructure, and you have experience in online content and distribution. And what you need to do, in my view, I think the best way for Tasmania to approach learning is to adapt and indeed lead the way in working toward distributed, student-centered learning networks. That's my view. Your reality may differ. Most people say that to me. So that's, to me, that's the role of education, is rethinking education, moving it to the edges, decentralizing it, putting it into the hands of learners. And we'll pause for a few moments, and I'll take some comments or questions if anyone has any. How's that for saving time?
This is Derek from Harvard College.
Sure.
With using e-learning for students, what I start to find more and more is that the seamless uptake of the e-environment of our students seems to be quite easy with the academic-able students and students that always have gone there. And when we talk about e-learning, most of our experiences with universities with high-end learning ability from the students, I have found great difficulty in getting the other sort of group of students to get into that environment that I have. lesser ability from the students.
Okay.
All
right. Yeah. I mean, I won't go that way. I'll go this way. As I said, I just rode on a bus to Strawn. And you know, without insulting the people of Strawn, I would imagine that that's probably the sort of person you're talking about, because, you know, they haven't been...
No, it's not those type of people.
Okay, well, what type of people then? Because okay, tell me.
I'm talking about the difference of the top 20% students and then the rest.
Well, okay, good enough. If you're not, you're going to create some kind of artificial distinction. But I'm going to go with my story anyway, because I'm not referring to the people of Strawn. I'm referring to the people who ride buses. How's that? I'm not going to dig myself out of this. The point that I wanted to make with that very bad introduction is, as I sat on that bus, every person, except me, interestingly, every person on that bus had an electronic device. And you could tell when we went in and out of cell range, because, you know, there are a bunch of them SMSing, and you know, a lot of them were listening to music off their MP3s and so on. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts that the people that you're talking about don't have trouble with things like playing games online. Not a problem, right? In fact, the big problem with them is you can't get them to stop and focus on their studies. My answer to the sort of criticism that you raise is that the problem isn't with the student. And when you say, you know, there's this big 80% of students, whether they live in Strawn or ride buses or whatever, who cares, right? And, well, probably the people in Strawn care, but heading to bus company. But, I mean, the suggestion is these people just aren't able to adapt to internet technology. And it's so obviously untrue. It's like software designers who say, well, we make a software product for everyone, but 80% of the people are too stupid to use it. Now, that wouldn't work as a way of designing software. Companies have tried and failed. And it doesn't work as a way of approaching education. They can use advanced technology. They do it every day. They just don't use online learning. And so the question is, why not? And the answer, in my view, is that online learning does not relate in any way to their experience of technology. I've done a bunch of talks already in Australia. It's a little off this talk, but a bunch of talks talking about what's called the new student. And it's this whole digital native, digital immigrant kind of thing. Except they don't really like that kind of distinction, but we'll leave that aside. But people who grew up with technology have very little patience for things like instruction. When they go to use a piece of software, it either works or it doesn't. The manual in a piece of software is used to hold up the end of the table. That's what it's good for. If the software doesn't tell them where to go next, they abandon the software. Game designers know this really well, because a game is, by definition, an optional exercise. So if the game, and a lot of these games are really complicated, involved, convoluted, they take hours and hours, days to play. Incredible complexity in games. You know, you have people out there who know everything there is to know about Myst. Now, unfortunately, Myst does not exist, but nonetheless, they know everything about it. And they learned all of this playing the game of Myst. And what the games do is they teach them in context. They bring them along. They have an activity that they're up to, whatever it is, and the different games vary in the different goals. But the point here is they're not taking education, setting it aside, saying, okay, now we'll learn about the game, lesson one, so on and so forth. Nobody would play a game if you had to do that. So the reason why students do not adapt well to online learning as it is currently structured is because online learning as it is currently structured is not adapted well to students. But we have many examples of things that are. And instead of trying to change the students to get them to be, nice, neat, in a row, goal-directed, linear, it makes a lot more sense to design online learning to adapt to what the students do, or what the students are like. So that's how I would approach that. Does that satisfy your...
Yes and no. I have tried different things, and what I'm trying to say is that the underpinning skill to effectively use e-technology is so complex that, for example, your example of MIST, I've got a class where those students just refuse to play because it's too complex a game. When I tried to do online collaborative work, the trying to learn how to use FrontPage or Dreamweaver so they can do some collaborative stuff or even some of those simple portals. Some of those underpinning skills that are needed are quite complex, and I think that is what the limiting factor is of bringing it to a broader audience that you know.
Well, I mean, when you want somebody to learn to drive, you don't put them in a Formula One race car and say, hit the gas. MIST is complicated. FrontPage is ridiculously complicated. Like, FrontPage is classic Microsoft systems technology where everything you could possibly want to do is there and somewhere in a menu if you can only find it. We look at the technology that has enjoyed wide adoption, particularly among younger people, and you see things like blogs. Right? Blog is a very simple technology. Blog is a technology that people can understand like within seconds of their first encountering it. It's an excellent entry-level technology. These games typically do the same sort of thing. They introduce you with something very simple, a training area, some simple things. Now, I don't know if you've introduced MIST in one of your classes and said, learn this. I think we're dealing also with question of intent and motivation as well as with the software. I mean, when's the last time you did a hobby because somebody said, okay, now I want you to do wood carving or whatever, and that's what you're going to do for fun now for the next 3 hours. So there's a combination of factors at work here. But I still think that the point holds that technology is widely adopted by students. Maybe not e-learning technology, but a wide range of other technologies. And so it's necessary for people who are involved in e-learning to learn about the design and structure of the software that is actually used by younger people today. I think that point holds. And I don't think that saying students refuse to use such and such in my carefully structured class, I don't think that that counts as a counterexample to that. What are they doing outside the class? What are they doing if they're not being told what to do? That's where we have to draw the lessons from.
I'd just like to follow on a couple of points that Joey just said, and I think it's one thing to come from learning on the internet, and I've learned a lot, but I've come from that, probably you have come from too, from a background where you had a structured, formalised learning education system, so, and I don't know what the results would be if it were entirely student-directed learning, and I think people still like the security of some form of institutionalization, and they, numbers going to university and training and education are probably getting bigger even since the internet age. And the other point I'll make is separate, but I'll just say, I've got the microphone, is that I think you're overly pessimistic about, standardized, online learning being completely standardized. I mean, where I work with systems education is we've got four or five teachers, say, in year 10, and, I had a student who had gone to opportunity, very interested in history, and it was a good idea for us to do some drama, so you know, I gave him a big bet, I got the text online, I've got Richard Wikipedia, good activities, and he did some great work. And as teachers, we're often hit with the criticism that we're actually not standardised enough. You know, my kid goes to any school in Australia, you know, this grade 10, he should be able to, you know, just be doing fairly similar work. So I think there are criticisms to be made in education, but I don't think the, you know, one size fits all is probably one of them.
Okay, two major points here. I'll address the first one because it's easy. The observation that attendance at universities is continuing to increase. And I'll throw that out. I'll throw out the thought experiment. What if universities no longer granted degrees? Would people still be going to them in increasing numbers and paying that amount of money for it? I mean, we have to distinguish between the credentialing and the education here, right? We have to distinguish between what it is that the university offers a person, which basically is an entry-level requirement to employment, as opposed to what it thinks it's offering, which is an education. Now, that's not to deny that education occurs at universities. It undoubtedly does. But I don't think it's an automatic that people are continuing to go to university in increasing numbers because, and only because, that is the best way to offer an education. The second point, with regard to standardization, I don't know, how do I want to put this? Because I'm not arguing against standardization per se. I'm arguing against standardization in cases where it is misapplied. And the way I draw that distinction is, as I mentioned earlier, between syntactic standardization and semantic standardization. Now, the type of standardization that I think you're defending is what I would classify as semantic standardization. And you can put that under the rubric or heading of things like curriculum or stuff like that. It's essentially the principle that with a certain variability, everybody has to receive the same education. Now, it would be interesting if we were in a neutral position where we did not have an education system at all to see how that position could be sustained. What is the argument for it? Because on observation, if everyone had the same job, then we could say that everyone has to have the same education, but of course people have different jobs. On observation, if everyone had the same aptitude, then everybody should have the same education, but of course people have different aptitudes. It seems clear and evident by observation that people have different aptitudes, different employment, live in different places, and so on. So it becomes very difficult to understand how a standard education makes sense when people are so different. And so you say, well, what about the foundations? What about reading? In fact, I remember very clearly sitting at a talk, I believe it was in San Diego, the location is important here, and came up with something along those lines. The speaker, it wasn't me, came out with something very much like what I just said. And a person in the audience said, well, what about the foundations that are absolutely essential to everyone? What about reading, writing, mathematics, theology? I sort of did a double take. The thing is, one person's standard is another person's option. And it's easy to say, oh yeah, everyone must read, and everyone must write, but if we and everyone must do math. But if we analyze that, I mean, this is the reply that was offered by Seymour Papert when he gave a talk at RIMA in Quebec City when a similar question was posed. If it's foundational, then the need for it will become apparent in the pursuit of less foundational enterprises. If it's not foundational, then it won't be necessary. So the determination of what is foundational and what is not foundational is obtainable in practice, and indeed, arguably, better obtainable in practice than through the determination of some set of things that are core and foundational prior to any practice. Trigonometry is a good example. It's considered foundational, or at least it was, I don't know about here, but when I was in high school, trigonometry was considered foundational. You had to have trigonometry to graduate high school math. Now, for the life of me, through the rest of my life, I have yet to see how trigonometry is foundational. Now, having said that, in actual, if you want to know what I learned, I took trigonometry 3 times. Because I took trigonometry in high school, and then I took it in college, and then, because I did 1 year of computer science in college, and then I took it again in university because they decided that I hadn't learned it in high school and in college. Not with testing, right? They just sort of looked at the transcript and said, no, you haven't learned it. So I took it 3 times. When I actually learned it, I didn't learn it in university either. I actually learned trigonometry when I was trying to design a Star Trek game. And because in Star Trek games, you have the front viewer, right? And in that front viewer, you have objects. And one of the things you want to do is rotate those objects. And the only way to do that is with trigonometry. And happily, when I was doing that, I just happened to have some trigonometry texts, 3 of them, in fact, sitting on my bookshelf. And so I was able to grab the text, look it up, and, oh, okay, that's how you do that. And angle, rotation, blah, 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 blah. And I was able to, well, actually, I wasn't that good a programmer then, so my cube sort of rotated. I got the trigonometry part right, but the graphics part sort of, and then squashed. And that's when I tried to do an adventure game instead of Star Trek. But you see the point that I'm making, right? Or I hope you do, even if you're not convinced. I hope I'm being clear with the argument that I'm making. I didn't hear a word of that, except the word trigonometry, but I think I was attuned to it. If I hadn't learned the trigonometry in the first place, I wouldn't have known what I needed to know. And you know, you'd think so. But as I was trying to design these things, I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I went online looking for graphic design help. How do you rotate? And I did a search, and rotate a cube. And I found the site that said, rotate a cube, here's the trig you need. So I didn't even, after having taken trigonometry 3 times, I didn't know that trigonometry would be useful in rotating cubes. So, standardization, I mean...
Stephen, how does that factor kind of you as a particular type of learner, though, versus the variation?
Yeah. We have that was very diplomatically phrased. The variation. I hear this all the time. Because, like, in my prior life, I do have a prior life. I was a philosopher, and in particular a logic instructor. And I felt that it was important that people exercise the capacities of critical thinking, reasoning, in their college and university work. And in fact, I expected that of my students. And people said, well, you can't expect this. I mean, they're not ready to do this. People want to be given the information that they need and the things that they need to know, and not to use logic on it, because, you know, even if you ask them to do it, they won't do it. And my response then, and my response to this particular issue is, to a large degree, we have educated our students in such a way that they're not able to A, think independently, which is the critical thinking part, and B, learn independently. And it's a bit much to turn around and say, because we haven't given them this capacity, that now we should not give them this capacity. And it's circular. If we structured our educational system in such a way, so as to allow the maximum empowerment of the individual, both in terms of reasoning ability and learning ability, then a lot of the argument that students won't think, students won't learn, would disappear. I mean, we can make them memorize state capitals, more or less, and we can make them memorize multiplication tables. It seems to me that we ought to have, in our collective intelligence and wisdom, the capacity to encourage students to think, reason, and learn autonomously. If we can't do that, we are in horrible, tremendous trouble, because most of what we learn, even in today's society, we learn independently. And if we want to get people to the levels of higher education, we need to give them this capacity to do it the entire way. And it comes back to, instead of us providing them with whatever, giving them the capacity to do it for themselves.
Well, thanks, that was a comprehensive answer.
Yeah, I do that.
I wasn't really speaking in defense of standardization. In fact, I was saying that I think there's a lot less of it than you would have. There's a lot more individualization in online learning. And the other point was simply that I think we don't know what unstructured learning looks like. So.
Well, again, people confuse autonomy with unstructured. That's not true either. If a person is freely able to move around the city of Rome, they still use a map. All right. So autonomy doesn't mean unstructured. The difference here is between being part of a tour group and saying, okay, first we'll see St. Paul's, then we'll see the Hadrian's Gate, and then we'll see whatever, versus having a map and picking your own direction. It doesn't eliminate structure. As for the remark about standardization isn't as common as you may think, that's a good thing. But what I'm reacting to here is the very widespread push towards standardization that we are seeing certainly in North America and definitely in the field of educational technology. I'm not going to get to all the slides in the next part, but I do want to talk about the story of RSS, because it really illustrates what I'm trying to get at. RSS, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, is what might loosely be called an XML specification for the indexing of the contents of websites where the contents change a lot. It's a very simple standard specification. It's title and link and description, and that's about it. Nonetheless, RSS is chaos in action, quite literally. There are no standards bodies describing RSS. It's not recognized by the World Wide Web Consortium. It's certainly not recognized by IEEE or ISO or anything like that. There is no organization whatsoever. There's no body or committee or anything like that. In fact, there's no single thing known as RSS. As Mark Pilgrim observed a little while ago, there are no fewer than 9 separate iterations of RSS. And that's not counting the extensions and the modules that people add to it. And in fact, just to make life a little more interesting, nobody agrees on what RSS stands for. Some people say it stands for Rich Site Summary. That's the camp I fall into. Other people say it stands for RDF Site Summary. Other people say it stands for Really Simple Syndication. Other people say it shouldn't be called RSS at all, but it should be called ADAM, and all of the tags should be different. That's the world of RSS. Now, contrast that with learning object metadata, which is highly standardized, highly organized. It's got its 87 fields. You got IMS, you've got IEEE learning object metadata. You've got SCORM, which is the de facto standard that all educational application designers need to follow. Very rigid, very precise. And if you look at the two, RSS and IEEE LOM, and you ask yourself, well, which one has more uptake? And you'd think, well, if standardization is the way to go, the standard actually built through the process that everyone agrees on, the one that is almost a requirement for technology, that ought to be the one that everyone's using. But in fact, it's RSS that has millions of users. It's RSS that's become, more or less, the de facto standard for blogs, for newspaper websites, for journals, so on and so forth. The non-standardized approach has had a much greater uptake than the standardized approach. And the reason, I argue, is twofold. Number one, RSS is simple. Because it wasn't built through this committee process, RSS ended up being only that which people could agree on. And what it turned out that people could agree on was very little. And second, just about everything in RSS is optional. You're not required, well, I suppose you really have to have the RSS at the top just to indicate that you're doing something like RSS. But any tag could be left out, any tag could be added. Now, sometimes it won't validate, but it turns out that RSS files that don't validate, that aren't valid RSS files, nonetheless still work in all the applications designed for RSS. Because the people who write these applications understand that it's complete chaos out there. And you can't write for the standard. And what you have to do is write for what you think might come in, pick it up, interpret it the best you can, and make do with the results. RSS is much more flexible. People use what they want of it, they discard what they don't want of it. There's enough overlap that we can sort of say, kind of roughly, loosely, that it's a specification, but there's very little overlap. So, when I say I'm opposed to standards, what I really mean is, I'm opposed to one standard for all. I'm opposed to the idea that there is a single way to describe learning resources and that everybody must describe them in the same way and they must all use the same vocabulary, because educators and educational institutions are a lot like students in that they have different objectives, they have different capacities, they have different goals, and therefore they need a slightly different language and they need a slightly different approach to education.
Just
about
the three, so we're back on track.
Oh, we're back on track.
4 minutes.
Here's the story I've been telling pretty much throughout Australia, and I didn't mean when I came to Australia to give the same story in place after place after place, but that's kind of how it turned out, and so now you get it too. But that's not a bad thing. And the story is an interesting story. And it's this story. Because now we're into the section on the way forward. And recognize these themes. The small pieces. Autonomous agents. Individual entities. Whether they are people. Whether they are schools. Whether they are bits of educational software. Whether they are learning resources. Small pieces. Loosely joined. For those of you who are working in learning management systems and things like that, the model that you've been given is, you know, you have your learning objects and then you organize them and arrange them. Somebody asked in the introduction, in fact, way back when, in the introduction to this whole session, the actual phrase was used, arranging, I think it was, or sequencing, one or the other. But that seems to be the idea. But if we look on the internet, if we look at the way people are using content when they're not being told what to do, they don't organize things in a linear fashion. They're very loosely arranged. They're more like fish and crabs and seaweed in an ecosystem than they are like sentences and paragraphs and words in a chunk of text. Fast, furious, out of control. This, is the decentralization thing. This is kind of like, a lot like this talk, except maybe the fast part. I don't know. Depends on my speaking. I could probably speak faster. Never mind. It's hard to explain this one, but I'll try. It's hard to explain this one short, but in a short time. But when I say content as vocabulary, what I mean by that is that the actual resources, in some cases even the software, but certainly the educational content, and by this I mean not just text, but multimedia, sound, audio, video, whatever. All of these things that students are using now to create blogs, to put on their MP3 player, the things that they fling around cyberspace by themselves naturally, sometimes in secret because sometimes it's illegal and sometimes you're not supposed to do that in class. These things have been and are becoming the new vocabulary, where learning is no longer something structured, but now is an exchange of ideas and concepts using this new vocabulary. It's not a replacement of text, but it's an addition to text. Text forms part of it. The paradigm instance of this is the Van Halen song Right Now. And you include the video in this, because if you look at Right Now, the song has an audio track. It's a sequence of disconnected images. There's text flowing across the bottom, and it all forms a single idea. And that single idea is a single word or a single sentence in the student's vocabulary. And that becomes the unit of content that is flung back and forth. And so instead of and these things, instead of being organized in a linear sequence, it would make no sense to organize them in a linear sequence. And instead they fly back and forth, sometimes bouncing together, sometimes organized in the same space or at the same time. And the concepts come up out of the association or relation, one image to a piece of sound, one piece of text to a particular graphic. Learning on this model becomes more like, instead of listening to the radio or watching TV, a conversation, where the process of learning is joined inextricably to the process of living, the process of working, the process of life, and the content of learning is the product that is built out of that process, built and then exchanged in an ecosystem. And we come back to the role of education. The role of education becomes very different. The role of education becomes to foster and nurture this ecosystem. If there are things that educators think are important that need to be fed or that need to be available to students, it becomes a process not of pushing out and making people listen to, math lessons or whatever. It becomes feeding this ecosystem, being a part of it, joining in the conversation. I very explicitly designed my website as a learning website, and the learning website that I've designed isn't classes and lessons, it isn't push, but it's joining the conversation. It's one website out of an ecosystem of 300 or 400 instructional technology websites. And it becomes part of the conversation. That's the picture. Stepping very lightly through this now. I've talked a bit about wikis already. And I talked already about Wikipedia. And I'll refer you also to a wiki called The Fuss. And again, the concept of the wiki is that anybody can edit any page. Now, what makes the wiki work is not that it's complex technology, but that it's very simple technology. When you go to edit a page in the wiki, you're basically presented with an editing screen, and that's it. And the commands. Well, what you're supposed to do in a wiki, and it actually says it on the wiki page, just start typing. Type what you want, hit enter, and you're done. Very simple technology. That's why Wikipedia has 1 million pages, because anybody can create a page, and many people do. I talked about content management systems already today. Scoop, PostNuke, Drupal, Plone, Moodle, which is the learning management system, so on and so forth. If we actually pop into these things, I don't have time to pop in, but the link is there. Same kind of thing. You are presented with an input screen. If you're adding content to one of these things, the spot for a title, a little drop down to select a category, and a big box to type in, and that's it. Very simple technology, simple to use. And what happens with this technology is that it allows somebody to create a content management system, a website based on such a system, very simply and easily. There's virtually no learning curve to contributing to one of these. Blogs. How many of you have heard of blogs? Yeah. Here's another bit of technology that had no organizing committee, had no large corporate backing, certainly grew without government support. And a blog, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, is a website with multiple entries, multiple bits of content, where these entries are dated and where these entries are displayed in reverse chronological order. In other words, most recent first. Blogging software allows people to create a blog entry, again, using a very simple form. The title of the blog entry and the actual text of the individual post. And you just type your stuff into the form, you've created a blog post. Now, what's significant, I'm not sure if it's on the next slide. Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah. Sorry. RSS, I've already talked about. Here's an example of this sort of pseudo-RSS code. Again, what I'm trying to draw out here is the idea is it's very simple technology. I wrote a paper once called How to Create an RSS Feed with Notepad, a Web Server, and a Beer. And I've been arguing ever since about whether or not the beer is optional. But again, this is something that pretty well anyone with the inclination could do. Notepad only has one field, right? And you open Notepad, you type that, or something very similar to that, you have an RSS feed. And actually, in my article, what I said is you actually open somebody else's RSS file and then just put in your content. It's even easier. You don't have to type all those angle brackets. These technologies are huge. Millions and millions of users. They have become the de facto semantic web. Open Archives Initiative. Same story, different players. The Open Archives Initiative is started out as a very unofficial initiative to allow people to put collections of journal articles on their website, either as individuals or, as more common in the case, institutional. Very simple specifications are used. The software itself, of course, is freeware. It's written in Perl, so you can go change it if you want. The actual metadata that's used to describe the journal articles is basic Dublin Core. You don't even get fancy. So again, you're back to, you know, the title author, because it's a much more complex thing. You need author, a publisher in some cases, and then a description, or as they say in academia, abstract of the item in question. And that's pretty much it. Oh, and the URL, because you have to find the thing. Talking about learning object repositories and so on and so forth, if you look at the uptake of OAI, last time I looked at it, it was about 435 institutions are participating, and they had just gone over, what was it? Was it a million? Or no, it was 4 million, as I recall, journal articles available through OAI. And how do I know that? Because OYSTER is a service that goes out and brings the records from all of these institutions together and just indexes them while it counts them too.
Is OAI just the index to the hard copy journals, or is it online copies of journals?
No, these articles are online. These articles are available for free. Anyone can read them. Okay? And if you're thinking of the other approach, if you will, because you do have, you know, these subscription-based hard copy journals, and they've been saying, oh, well, we've got to get online, right? Because, you know, the world's passing us by. So what they did is they set up large centralized repositories. They charge large subscription fees to access them. You can only access them through your college or university computer, because it checks the internet address, or through a VPN, a virtual, private or public, I can never remember, network. Anyhow, you go through all this authentication Or you can buy access on a case-by-case access for something like $30 an article, which really kills me. $30 an article, and you read the article, and no, that's not what I want. I could go through several hundred dollars worth of articles in an afternoon. And that was their version of putting stuff online. Again, it's this large centralized solution versus something very open, very distributed. Right now, academic publication is in serious flux. There was a major committee in Britain recommended that British educational institutions abandon traditional academic publishing and embrace open access. Well, what happens if you're in the publishing business and all of a sudden the product that you were selling for like $10,000 a pop is now available to everyone for free? And this is one of these things, you talk about business model, but the publisher's business model is very precarious, and it depends on academics having to give them stuff for free in order to obtain promotion. That's the model. If somebody was going to start a new business and say that was the model they were going to build it on, people would say, you're nuts. Who in their right mind would do this? It's one of these things that evolved historically, but when you look at the new affordances enabled by the internet, you realize that the old way of content control just doesn't work anymore. What's happened in the RSS world, and for that matter the OAI world, is that when you have all of these multiple bits spread out all across the internet, and when the information is expressed in RSS, whichever variety, you get the development of what are called harvesters or aggregators. And the sole purpose of these things is to bring the material from all the separate places where it's been created, bring it together. You don't bring all the material itself, you just bring what's called the metadata, the information about the content that's out there. Bloglines, for example, is a site on the World Wide Web that you can go to and you can choose to what they call subscribe to RSS feeds. And what that means is you choose out of the 4 million or so feeds that are available, you choose the 5 or 10 or 100 or whatever. Most people read only about 20 or 30. It's very interesting. Feeds that you want to read on a regular basis. And then what Bloglines does is it goes out, it gets the RSS, brings it back, and then it displays it to you on our nice web page. And you might think, well, how can people find 20 or 30 feeds out of 400 or so? Well, the easiest way I've discovered by experience is to create your own blog and start writing about stuff that you're interested in. And then go to Bloglines and subscribe to it. Because what Bloglines will do is it'll look at the feed that you've subscribed to and it will start recommending similar feeds to you. And so by defining and contributing your own content to the internet, that is the mechanism by which the internet can start suggesting content to you. It's a conversation. Technorati, Feedster, Blogdex, Daypop, Popdex, all variations on the theme. It's important to keep in mind that there's not just one aggregator out there. There are multitudinous aggregators out there, all harvesting, all repurposing, all remixing, all feeding the stuff forward. Why did I link to that? Oh, well, 320. I know why I linked to that. I wanted to say that my website is an instance of this ecosystem in action. If you go to downs.ca, you'll actually see that the content displayed in what appears to be a self-contained package is actually content that has been gathered together in this way, using these sorts of feeds. Now, what in fact I have done in my own work is built something called EduRSS. EduRSS is something that's very similar to Bloglines or Technorati or whatever, except Instead of harvesting all of the RSS feeds that are out there, because who can afford to build a system that harvests 4 million feeds? Right? What I did is I set up a system that harvests about 300 of them. And what I did is I picked very specific feeds that I wanted to harvest from. There we go. I'm just going to pop into this because I want to show this to you rather than just talk about it. And we wait because it's Windows. And where are we going to go? We're going to go nowhere. So, anyhow, EduRSS brings these together. And boy, that's something. It's not the connection. I know the connection is good. Here we go. Here's what EduRSS brought in, and now this is from 300 educational RSS feeds. This is what it brought in today. I haven't seen this yet. Fair warning. So, see, it's a bit of a slow day. Usually it's a lot more than that. Nonetheless, still pretty unmanageable, right? Now, what I've done with EduRSS is I've taken this a step further, and I've created something called EduRSS Topics. And what EduRSS Topics does is it takes the content from these 300 or so feeds and it organizes them. It adapts them a little bit, and then it outputs topic-specific web pages or RSS feeds. If I just zip into one, not being quite that random, but learning objects, for example. Suppose you wanted to learn about learning objects. Here is an EduRSS feed specific to learning objects. Okay, and so here's what's come out recently in learning objects. And you notice the paces here is a lot more manageable, right? October 1, there was one item. September 29, two items. September 28, 3, 4, I was busy day, 4, 5 items. That's a heavy day. But it's much more manageable now, isn't it? What you've got here now is the collective wisdom of some 300 or so people writing in the field of educational technology, their combined views on the topic of learning objects presented to you. I submit, and anyone can test this empirically if they like, that this is the single most authoritative source of information and utterly the most useful learning tool in the field of learning objects that exists today. You know how much work I do to put together this particular display? None. It just runs automatically. I did at some point in time pick the 300 feeds, and I cull and shape it. It's like my little bonsai tree, right? Select the feed. I sort of work. I think about it. Do I really want to include? But work? I don't work to put this together. Back to the presentation. I did the same thing for learning objects. I kind of ignored learning object metadata, although I did write, because RSS is very extensible, I wrote a version of RSS that I call RSS LOM to adapt to learning object metadata. But in fact, nobody uses RSS LOM, so it didn't matter. And what I did is I went out and I convinced some of these institutional repositories to actually make their metadata available to other people. Now, this took convincing because they thought that they own something, right? They own information. They thought that they can make a lot of money keeping metadata for themselves. They didn't want to share. But gradually, I went to one and another. This is a known error, so I really need to fix that. Gradually convinced Cario, Edna, Global Education, Merlot, Maricopa, so on and so forth, to contribute RSS feeds to be harvested by DLORN. And DLORN works in the same way, with a few quirks, as EduRSS, and here's the stuff that came in DLORN. And this is the stuff. These are the new learning objects that have been produced out there today. not so much traffic, but you know, it's new technology and people aren't really producing learning objects the way they're producing blog posts and things like that. I haven't organized it into topics, but Edna has a really nice listing of topics, and when I get a sufficient base of resources in DMOR, I'm going to take Edna's topic index and apply that and create separate RSS feeds for each and every topic that Edna lists. And the idea here is that the idea here is that I am bringing resources together, not from one college, not from one university, not even from one country, but from all around the world, bringing them together, and then that allows me to create very topic-specific streams of learning resources. Because the model that I'm trying to suggest, I know, is that learning resources, learning itself, learning content especially, isn't like we think, static objects. It's not even like we think, or like I've suggested, words in a conversation, because these things are too fixed. Learning is much more dynamic than that. Learning and information is much more dynamic than that. And the approach, the way of thinking about learning, the actual metaphor we should have in our mind, is learning not as resources, not even as services, but as infrastructure like electricity, like water, flowing through the walls, available up there as needed. I mean, if you think that's astounding and amazing, we could never possibly do that, keeping aside the fact that we have done that for water and electricity, think about writing. And we put writing wherever we want it. You're all wearing writing. And the model of learning in the future is that you could be just as easily wearing learning as writing. And you could be teaching all about yourself while I'm standing here talking to you, or teaching me about whatever. Or that learning could be contained, like writing is today, in a fishing rod or on a jar of strawberry jam. So, yeah, you can hardly read that. I found this in Strawn. If we can revise our attitudes toward the land under our feet, if we can accept a role of steward and depart from the role of conqueror, if we can accept the view that man and nature are inseparable parts of the unified whole, then Tasmania can be a shining beacon in a dull, uniform, and largely artificial world. Now, my message today, if there is a message, if there's one single thing I would say, is that this applies not only to environment and ecology. It applies in society as a whole. Nature includes ourselves. And we have to think of ourselves, each other, not as things that we conquer and control and command, but things over which we have a stewardship, things with which we have to live in harmony. It's a distributed view, it's a challenging view, it's a hard view. But I really think if the objective is to become the leader in the use of information and communication technology, in learning, education, and skills, then something like this is the model that is going to be the way forward. And you want opportunity, there's a world of opportunity following something like this. And I am out of time.
Are you happy to take a couple of questions?
Yeah. I'm not out of time. You're out of time, but I can keep going.
Any last questions to say before you go? I've just got one, Stephen. Should we drop what we're doing and go to open source everything right now and hang next
thing? Well, I mean, you saw the slides from Friday.
Yes, they have.
Yeah. Look, things are transitional, right? Well, except maybe for that telephone. You don't drop what you're doing now and suddenly adopt the new thing. Nothing happens overnight. So, you know, I would drop Windows and start using Linux, particularly if you're not familiar with it, because it'll be too sudden. Not everything in open source is ready for prime time. You have to do things incrementally and gradually. You know, I talk about this sort of stuff, right? Don't forget, I'm a philosopher, right? I don't think about tomorrow. I think about the longer term. So, like, tomorrow, you still have to get up. You still have to go to work. You still have to do what your employer told you. And with any luck, you'll still get a paycheck at the end of the week. You'll still be using Microsoft. You'll still be driving cars. Things won't change. This is about having a direction and having a goal. So if tomorrow, when you get up and your supervisor says something to you, you need to do something or you need to use a piece of software, and if the response is altered subtly and slightly in the direction of equitable relationships, in the direction of distributed responsibility, in the direction of open source, then that incremental step takes you a little bit toward it, toward the end. You know, I mean, you don't become something that you're not overnight. It never works. But you become a little bit every day. Learning theorists will talk about habituation and things like that. You need to habituate yourself into the idea of living in an educational ecosystem. And it won't happen suddenly. But it can happen in time. As long as you know, that's where you're going.
Thank you, Stephen.
And now get away from the podium.
Okay. No, stay there, please. On behalf of everyone, I'd like to really thank you for all of the above, and I'm sure everyone's going back to their workplace rethinking about their thinking, and the fact that our new curriculum for the school sectors, based on teaching for understanding and actually getting kids to think, really sits well with everything you say. So we'll be thinking a lot. And we've got a small gift for you. This is one of our wilderness calendars, so hopefully it'll give you good memories of Strawn. And I should tell you now that most Tasmanians in this room are probably related to somebody in Strawn.
I've heard that.
But we won't hold that against you, nor broadcast it in our various blogs. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Just because I would like to make it clear that I enjoyed not only the village or town, nobody told me which it was, the village or town of Strawn, but also the people. And I talked with a lot of them while I was there. I think they were just open, welcoming, lovely people. And I want to go back one day. And now for the rebuttal.
And thanks everyone for coming today. I'm sure that you had a wonderful, stimulating, exciting experience. I'd just like to, in closing, thank some key people who have been really instrumental in today's proceedings. Elizabeth Todd, I think, in the first instance, identifying the opportunity for Steve to come to the domain. Jen Dunlevin, who's put a huge amount of effort into this. And to Janine Bose for doing work that she's done today, facilitating, and of course Jen Lynch has done much of the administrative work. So thank you everyone, and thank you for those people who made today possible, and again, Stephen, thank you.